In this session, we will look at the tax implications that arise when a company goes into administration or liquidation. Firstly, it is important to clarify a couple of legal principles. There is a distinction between an administrator and a liquidator. A company which is in financial difficulty may go into administration. An administrator is appointed to manage the company's affairs. When an administrator or receiver is appointed, this is basically like calling the doctor. The company is experiencing severe bad health, but is still alive, and the administrator or receiver is called in to see if the company can be turned around and brought back to life. The company continues to trade, and the administrator normally seeks to sell the company as a going concern. If this is not possible, the administrator will normally achieve a better price for the company's assets than would be likely if the company went straight into liquidation. The appointment of a liquidator is like calling an undertaker. The company has died, and there is no hope of a recovery. Liquidation brings the existence of the company to an end. When a company is wound up, a liquidator is appointed to sell all the assets, pay all the debts, and return any surplus capital to the shareholders. On completion of the winding up, the company is dissolved. Liquidation can be voluntary or compulsory. Voluntary liquidation is where the company chooses to be liquidated. This normally applies where the company is solvent. The liquidation starts when the members pass a resolution to wind up the company voluntarily. Compulsory liquidation is when the company is ordered by a court to be wound up on the petition of perhaps the company's creditors, directors, or one or more members. This normally applies where the company is insolvent and cannot pay its debts. In either case, the liquidator becomes the beneficial owner of the company's assets and is responsible for the payment of all corporation tax liabilities arising after the commencement of winding up. Let us take a look at the effect on accounting periods for tax purposes. First of all, companies in administration. The appointment of an administrator causes a new accounting period to begin. The old accounting period will end the day before the appointment, and a new one will begin on the day of the appointment. During the administration period, the normal rules with respect to accounting periods apply. An accounting period will also come to an end when a company has been rescued by the administrator and moves out of administration. Now let us look at the effect of the appointment of a liquidator, which basically starts the liquidation process. The appointment of a liquidator causes a new accounting period to begin. As with the appointment of an administrator, the old accounting period ends the day before the appointment and a new one begins on the day of the appointment. Once a liquidator is in place, the accounting period will end on the earlier of 12 months or the conclusion of the winding up. This means that if the company ceases to trade once the liquidator is appointed, this will not result in the end of an accounting period. However, if the company moves out of liquidation and into administration, an accounting period comes to an end at that date and a new one begins. Farcasso Limited has a year end of the 30th of September. The liquidator is appointed on the 1st of December 2009. The trade ceases on the 12th of March 2010, and the liquidation is completed by the 14th of January 2011. Taking a look at a timeline, our first accounting period is from the 1st of October 2008 to the 30th of September 2009. The company's normal year end will not be affected, as the liquidator has not yet been appointed. On the 1st of December 2009, the liquidator is appointed. This will automatically end a previous accounting period, and from this point onwards, the company is in liquidation. Accounting periods now run for the next 12 months, so our third accounting period will start from the appointment of the liquidator and end a year later, on the 30th of November 2010. The cessation of trade on the 12th of March 2010 has no effect on the accounting periods. The final accounting period runs from the 1st of December 2010 to the 14th of January 2011 on completion of winding up. We will now look at the timing of the cessation of trade. If trade ceases before the liquidator is appointed, then a new accounting period will begin, as the cessation of trade before liquidation will end an accounting period, and a new one will immediately begin. If trade ceases during liquidation, there is no effect on accounting periods. If the company is a close company, it could become a close investment holding company at the beginning of the first complete accounting period when it is not trading. The effect of it being classified as a close investment holding company is the fact that the full rate of tax, currently 28% for financial year 2010, applies to all of the company's income, as the small profits rate and marginal relief is denied to close investment holding companies. Let us take a look at a line diagram. Here we have a company which is trading and then goes into liquidation. Trade ceases after the liquidator has been appointed. Taking the first accounting period during liquidation, which is 12 months long, the company is trading for some of that accounting period, and it only becomes a close investment holding company on the start of a brand new period, which will be 12 months from the commencement of liquidation. However, if we take the situation where the cessation of trade takes place before the liquidator is appointed, the cessation of trade will result in the start of a new accounting period, and the company will immediately become a close investment holding company, and therefore liable to the full 28% rate at a much earlier point. Let us now continue the example of Farcasa Limited. What I would like you to do is to type in the box as day-day, month-month, year-year, the point at which the company becomes a close investment holding company for tax purposes. Select continue when you are ready. Taking a look at our accounting periods. The first accounting period is the normal 30th of September year-end to the 30th of September 2009. The next accounting period ends on the day before the liquidator is appointed, on the 1st of December 2009. The third accounting period then runs through to the 30th of November 2010, i.e. 12 months following the appointment of the liquidator. Trade ceases in March 2010, but this has no effect on the company's accounting periods. Therefore, the company does not become a close investment holding company until the 1st of December 2010, i.e. at the beginning of the first accounting period in which it is not a trading company. Would the answer differ if the trade ceased on the 1st of November 2009? Again, taking a look at our timeline, the company's first accounting period ends on the 30th of September 2009. The trade ceases on the 1st of November 2009. This will end an accounting period, and immediately a new one will begin. Because at the beginning of this accounting period, the company was not trading, it immediately becomes a close investment holding company and liable to the full rate of corporation tax. The next accounting period will run through for the time the liquidator is appointed. The following accounting period will run to the next 12 months, and the final accounting period will end when winding up is completed on the 14th of January 2011. We will now look at the tax effects during the liquidation. Firstly, with regard to expenses incurred. If the liquidator continues to carry on the trade, then the normal rules apply. Therefore, as we are aware, expenses are only deductible for tax purposes from trade profits where they are incurred wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the trade, which is given under the Corporation Taxes Act 2009, Section 54. So, what about the liquidator's fee? Where the fee relates to the liquidator running the trade, and it has been incurred wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the trade, then it is deductible. However, where the fee related to the actual liquidation, the sale of the company's assets followed by distribution to creditors and shareholders, then the fee is not deductible, as it does not satisfy the wholly and exclusively for trading purposes test. The cessation of trade by the liquidator will result in a reclassification of the income. While the company is trading, it is taxable on its trade profit. However, where income is received following cessation of trade, it is taxed as a post-cessation receipt. Any post-cessation expenses can be deducted from these post-cessation receipts. The company's trading stock will be revalued to market value on the last day of trading under the Corporation Tax Act 2009 Section 162, which will result in either a profit or a loss, taxable or releasable as trade profit. The same adjustment applies to plant and machinery allowances, in that a market value adjustment is made on the last day of trading, which will trigger either a balancing allowance or a balancing charge. In many situations where a company is in liquidation, it is necessary to make employees redundant. What we will look at in this section is the tax relief available for redundancy payments that the company may pay. Where a trade is continuing, relief is available for redundancy payments under Section 54, as they will have been incurred wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the trade. Redundancy payments are made to staff that are leaving in order to maintain morale and cooperation of the staff that are remaining. This naturally satisfies the Section 54 test. However, in the case where the trade is ceasing, no relief will be available under Section 54 as there is no trade. This will be the case in a liquidation. However, it is a legal requirement that companies pay certain amounts of redundancy pay, and the Corporation Tax Act 2009 Section 76 provides the company with a trading deduction for statutory redundancy pay. In addition, Section 79 will allow a more generous company to pay additional amounts to staff and claim up to 3 times the statutory redundancy limit as a trading deduction. Any higher amounts paid than that will not receive any relief. Consequently, on cessation of trade, the company may deduct 4 times statutory redundancy pay, once under Section 76 and 3 more times under Section 79. A company in liquidation is often a loss-making company. When a loss-making company ceases to trade, relief is available for these trading losses by offset against total profits before charges of the loss-making period, and then carry back 3 years on a last-in, first-out basis against total profits before charges. This is also known as terminal loss relief. Therefore, it is advantageous for the company to realize chargeable gains prior to trade ceasing, as this enables the trading losses to be used against the company's total profits, which include chargeable gains. Alternatively, the trading losses may be group relieved to other members of the same group relief group. We will now look at liquidation and group provisions. With regard to the ownership of assets, there are 2 distinct terms. There is legal ownership and beneficial ownership. Legal ownership is simply the name of the person registered on the deeds with regard to property or the registered owner of shares in respect of shareholdings. The beneficial owner is the person who has all the benefits of ownership. It is common for the same person to be both the legal and beneficial owner. However, when a company goes into liquidation, it loses beneficial ownership of its assets as this transfers to the liquidator. This has an effect for tax purposes. The capital gains provisions are based upon legal ownership of assets. Consequently, as legal ownership has not changed, there is no disposal for capital gains purposes when the liquidator is appointed. Therefore, a company will not be deemed to sell, say, shares in subsidiaries, triggering any capital gains charges. Equally, no Section 179 charges will arise. For capital gains purposes, the company still remains part of the group because legal ownership remains unchanged. However, beneficial ownership is required for other group provisions, such as group relief and the possibility of a Corporation Tax Act 2010 Section 938 transfer of trade. This is covered in a separate section of this module. Consequently, if it is important to retain group provisions, for instance to ensure group relief continues, it may be necessary to consider a pre-liquidation reorganization. Have a look at the example on the screen. A Limited has 3 wholly owned subsidiaries, B, C and D. Once the company goes into liquidation, it will lose beneficial ownership of all of its subsidiaries, and no group relief will be available from that point onwards. Consequently, before the liquidation, the company may wish to restructure its operations. The group may restructure itself as follows. A will own all of B, and B will own both C and D. This will be done by A Limited transferring its shares in C and D to B, in return for a new issue of shares in B to A, which will not trigger any capital gains, as it will be done through the paper-for-paper rules. When A goes into liquidation, it will lose beneficial ownership of B. However, a valid group will be retained between B, C, and D, as beneficial ownership of the assets of B does not change as a result of A going into liquidation. This will allow, say, losses of C to be transferred to either B or D, even during liquidation of A. We will now look at the rules that apply to distributions, both before and after the appointment of a liquidator. Take a look at the line diagram. A distribution made before the liquidator is appointed is a straightforward dividend. For an individual shareholder, this will result in a higher rate or additional rate tax charge. Where the shares are owned by a corporate shareholder, the dividend will amount to franked investment income, which is not taxable on the company. However, once a liquidator has been appointed, any distributions made by the company will be capital and will rank as capital proceeds. More than one distribution will therefore give rise to a part disposal calculation. So far as an individual is concerned, any such distribution will be taxable under capital gains tax, and various reliefs will be available, for instance, entrepreneur's relief, which reduces the capital gains tax payable within a certain threshold to 10%. Where the shares are owned by a corporate shareholder, this will give rise to a gain, which will be subject to corporation tax. However, if the shares amount to a substantial shareholding, because the company owns at least 10% of the company in liquidation, then the exemption may apply. If not, the capital proceeds will be subject to corporation tax in the usual way. Let us take a look at an illustration of the capital versus dividend route for an individual shareholder. In the example, we have a company called Sinestro Limited, which goes into liquidation. Prior to the liquidation, a distribution of £30,000 is paid to Ginny, who is an additional rate taxpayer liable to £10,833 of tax. After the liquidation, she receives £40,000, which is treated as capital proceeds. We then deduct the cost, giving us a gain of £38,500. Assuming that the shares do not qualify for entrepreneur's relief, this gain will be taxed at 28%, resulting in a CGT liability of £10,780. What I would like you to do is to decide whether Ginny would have been better off receiving the full £70,000 as a capital distribution, and if this is the case, what the tax savings would be. Let us now take a look at the solution. We start with the full £70,000 proceeds and deduct the cost, giving us a gain of £68,500 and a CGT liability at 28% of £19,180. The tax paid in the previous example was additional rate income tax of £10,833 and CGT of £10,780. The overall saving is £2,433. Finally, let's look at other tax implications of the new rules introduced by the Enterprise Act. Looking at the rates of corporation tax, companies that are currently in liquidation may make early self-assessment returns in order to finalise their affairs based on tax rates applying in the previous tax year. Finally, on the subject of loan relationships, the connected party rules do not apply to companies which have gone into liquidation, as they are specifically overridden by the legislation. However, this override will only apply while the company remains in liquidation.
Where the company comes out of liquidation as a result of these new insolvency provisions, the connected party rules will be reinstated as they were before.
That concludes this session on administration and liquidations.